Hello, everyone. Happy Sunday, and welcome to Restoring Our Roots podcast, the voice of the decriminalized nature movement. This podcast is a gathering space where we explore the wisdom of entheogenic plants and fungi, the beauty of natural healing, and the importance of reconnecting to the sacred earth. Twice a month or more, we'll hear from visionaries, healers, and advocates who are working with entheogenic plants and fungi, exploring realms of consciousness, and returning us to a balanced relationship with nature. My name is Larry Norris. I'm the co-founder of Decriminalized Nature and the National Organizing Director. I've had the privilege, luckily, to help teams all across the U.S. Gather together, organize, educate their community, and pass policy. So if you are out there and you're looking to pass some policy locally in your jurisdiction, your municipality, please reach out to us at info@decriminalizednature.org or decriminalizednature.org. We do a monthly orientation. We get people set up, basically all the information they need, all the resources they need to go ahead and make this work in their different communities. I'd also like to introduce Rachel, who's our behind the scenes maverick there, helping us out with the production on the backside. Thank you, Rachel, for all your support and all your help. We're going live on YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. And in 1 week, we'll have the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many other platforms. So come check us out there. If you are interested in donating, please go ahead and put a little click on the donate button below, and we'll help us continue the show and continue the movement and continue to do good work out there. And then just for any of the live listeners that are out there right now, if you have any questions for Danielle or myself during the course of the show, please go ahead and put them into the chat box, and Rachel will be bringing those to us about 10 minutes or so before the end of the show. So thank you for that, and it's always good to have your participation as well. Really excited to have our guest today, Danielle Nova. Man, it's been quite a few years since we've been chatting together, and Danielle's currently the director of San Francisco Psychedelic Society, founder of Psychedelics and Recovery, doing some incredible work with microdosing and James Fadiman, which I'm excited to talk with you more about, and was one of the really key figures in the Decriminalized Nature Oakland movement, really helped out throughout the entire process, was really a strong community advocate and really being able to organize and bring community together. So looking forward to talking about all these wonderful things, and it's been a little while since we've had a little chat, so excited for you to be here. And you're living in Maui now, which is pretty great as well. So maybe we can even chat a little bit about Maui. And really, really happy to have you on this Thanksgiving Day weekend. So how are you doing today, Danielle?
I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you, Larry. And I was just reflecting before we got on our podcast together. It's been almost a decade that we've been orbiting together, collaborating in this space. So just really, you know, grateful for the collaboration and the work that you're doing with Decrim Nature. And thank you to everyone that's here listening to this conversation.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. Yeah. It's a decade. That's just flies by, right? You know, we feel like, I'm getting a little blonder, as they say, right? So maybe tell the audience, for those who don't know, a little bit about your background, how you got interested in this area, and kind of some things that you're really excited about right now. And then we'll kind of go from there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been working in the psychedelic space for almost a decade. I was brought to this work because I was severely addicted to drugs for 15 years. I got addicted to drugs as a teenager, both street drugs like opioids and cocaine and heroin, and got really addicted to prescription medications that I was put on as a child, and was in and out of treatment centers for over a decade, and went to like 8 different rehabs, was prescribed hundreds of psychiatric drugs on up to 20 medications at a time, and finally had an awakening that these drugs were really hurting me. And I used psychedelics to break out of 15 years of drug addiction, and plant medicine helped me save my own life. And ever since I experienced the transformative capacity of psychedelics to help me break out of these addictive patterns, I've just been devoting my life's work to it. So I've been working as the executive director of San Francisco Psychedelic Society since 2017, and provided psychedelic education programs and integration circles for over 25,000 people worldwide. And I really feel like our work with Decriminalized Nature Oakland opened up such a just emergence in my life and in our capacity to help so many people, especially around the world as well. It was really just, that was one of the most monumental moments of my life, honestly, to work on that initiative together. And I'd love to unpack that more and talk more about that. And I've also been working I founded this organization called Lumeria, and we've trained over 100 clinicians and practitioners to be certified microdosing facilitators. I've been really focused on the microdosing work for almost a decade, and I've been, teaching people how to microdose on their own, and more recently, in the past couple of years, been training providers how to help their clients or patients that are interested in microdosing. So that's been such a huge passion of my work, and really coming from a harm reduction lens to be able to teach people how to, get the maximum benefit out of their microdosing protocols.
Yeah, there's so many interesting avenues that we can go. Once we sort of broke through, as you mentioned, kind of change that policy, shift to people's ideas of what's possible. Doesn't have to be through these like overly regulated clinical models or these like highly regulated legalization frameworks, but just like stopping arresting people and then see what happens and see where the innovation comes out or what ideas people have or how they can bring things forward. And so it's really beautiful to see you've found so many different avenues that really come from your source, but also as you're developing and seeing things move in the field, how that kind of moves forward and what you kind of been drawn to. I'd love to, I mean, for folks out there, sometimes when they hear things like, and take this with a grain of salt, for people that don't know, using drugs to help yourself with drugs, just for the very general stigma of it, but working with psychedelics or entheogens to help you, as you said, break through addictive patterns. For someone that doesn't really understand what that means, could you help to break that down for us a little bit? What does that mean to break an addictive pattern? What does that look like the inner world? Like what are you experiencing that helps that process? So people that are interested in maybe exploring this for helping themselves with substance use issues can find a good way.
Absolutely. It's so multidimensional, the experience of it. I think, from my experience, when I really zoom out and I look at addiction in general or dependency, some people have a hard time with even the word addiction, especially when it comes to being on psychiatric drugs that you're dependent to. When I zoom out and try to understand it, the entire time I was addicted to drugs or dependent on drugs, I was actually just trying to heal the whole time. I was trying to heal. I was trying to come to wholeness. And yet these drugs suppressed emotions. They suppressed trauma. They suppressed my nervous system. But I was just trying to feel safe and connected and whole the whole time. It was a pursuit of wholeness. And I like to say it was the wrong drugs, honestly. And once I found psychedelics, this was back almost a decade ago, I actually didn't even know that ayahuasca helps heal or transform out of addiction. No one was talking about that. There wasn't any, research that was happening back then. So it was really, I almost died from coming off of all these drugs. And a friend brought me into an ayahuasca ceremony and just sponsored me and said, let's just see if, if this helps. And it snapped me out of this intense withdrawal process that I was going through. It actually caused more withdrawals in the ceremony, but afterwards, for the first time in my life, I didn't feel cravings and I didn't feel like I wanted to die. And I think, so much of addiction is an attempt to try to escape our reality. And what entheogens, entheogen, to discover the divine within, addiction is an attempt to fill a void. And entheogens remind us that we're already whole and they connect us with the void, which is the void of our divinity and the void of ourselves. And I think that's the power in these plant medicines, is that they connect us with source, with divinity, with our own power. The old paradigm of addiction treatment is to say that you're powerless over drugs and alcohol and you have to give up that power. And I believe that to really transform out of addiction is to realize that you are so powerful. You are more powerful than the addiction. And that you are the medicine, you're the one that's going to help you transform and transform entheogens. Just they're like the doorway, but you're the key to unlock that door. And they also help me. I think, the nature of entheogens is that they're neuroplastic, right? They create neuroplasticity in our consciousness, new neural pathways. And addiction is just a deeply ingrained neural pathway. If you do a drug over and over and over again, you start both identifying with the fact that you're an addict, you're going to be an addict for the rest of your life, and that you need this drug to survive. And entheogens help break us out of these addictive patterns. Addiction is just a pattern. If you do something over and over again, you're going to get familiar and comfortable within that pattern. And entheogens helped interrupt that pattern for me, and they opened up new neural pathways to believe that I could live life beyond addiction, and that I'm so much more than my addiction, and that the addiction was actually temporary. I'm not an addict anymore. I don't believe that it's a fixed construct. I believe it's something that actually addiction temporarily saved my life until until it started harming me. And I used entheogens to really transform out of that. And now I view my addiction as a gift. It's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I'm here today because of my suffering. And my suffering has been a portal to my purpose. And I'm so grateful for it. And that's another aspect of that psychedelics have taught me, to like really view our suffering as a gift.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things there. I mean, I really love the concept of this sort of holistic idea and the void. And we hear about this with all the clinical research, and they don't really talk about the mechanism too much. Why is it good for depression? Why is it good for anxiety? Why is it good for addiction or substance use issues? What's really happening there? What's the underlying non-numerical quantitative data set that can help you say, like, oh, okay, this is why it's helping you? And I think you just phrase that so beautifully, is like it really helps this void that's oftentimes causing some of these challenges, these difficulties that we have, is now being filled by this thing that says, hey, you're bigger than yourself. There's much more out there. The mystery is there. There's wonder, there's awe. And not that those things weren't maybe existing before, but I think that deep connection to that, on a sort of a deep intuitive body felt sense of it, rather than just an intellectual book read experience, makes a huge difference, especially as people are going through these big transformations. There's this idea, you probably heard of this quantum change theory, or this like sudden shift experience, where, and I think you sort of really spoke to this directly. Someone that was drinking, for example, doesn't need to stop drinking. They're just not a drinker anymore.
Yes.
So this is what you're speaking about. You don't have to go through the process of feeling, oh, I'm disempowered. You say, no, I'm this new person now. I'm this huge empowered individual, and that's over there, and that's in the past. And you don't have to necessarily, say, oh, this is, a horrible part of my life and shame and all that kind of thing. Still embrace it for lessons that you learn, but then moving into transitioning to almost this new being. What is that like in terms of, I know you have psychedelics and recovery as well. You're probably seeing a lot of people deal with this, working with this. What's that transition like, where you go from, previous self to new self? First, speak about that a little bit, and then also, like, how is that in terms of community building? Because it seems like the biggest challenge with transformation sometimes is you lose your community. All the people that you knew with your previous life are like, I don't know this person anymore. Are they still friends, or in that type of thing? So you see a lot of loss of community and isolation in the transformation process. So both speak a little bit to the shift in transformation, and also to the community aspect.
Yeah, I love what you said there about the letting go of the old life and almost like grieving the old life. I think that's an important part of it. And for some people, it looks like complete overnight transformation of just letting go. And I think for me, it was, in what I teach about, it's like it's a slow titration process. Because addiction is not something that I believe you can overcome overnight. It's on a spectrum, and it's cyclical too. And so for me, it was a slow unwinding of who I used to be. And I think even in the word recovery, it can be a dangerous word, and I'm trying to find a new word. It's a buzzword, so we use recovery. A lot of us in the addiction recovery community know what recovery means, but if you look at recovery, it's like to go back to who you were before, or to recover, or and it also implies that you're sick. And I don't think addiction is an illness. I think it's a deeply ingrained pattern of survival. And so what I teach people, it's like it's not about going back to who you were before or trying to recover your old self. It's really about, who do you want to become? Who are you beyond your addiction? And I think the main focus that we have is around our identity, because so much of like the old paradigm of addiction treatment programs, and especially community groups, like in the 12-step program, I used to have to say I'm an addict. Every time you introduce yourself, you program yourself to stay in addict consciousness. And we teach people that the drugs that you use, or the behaviors that you do, or the alcohol that you use does not define your identity. And I think that's a process that people have to really release the identity of addiction and realize that there's so much more than that. And also the belief that it's something that they can transform and overcome, and that they're not always going to be one step away from a relapse. And I think that can be difficult for people because, especially when they're approaching plant medicine and recovery, it's like, is this going to re cause me to relapse? And what we like to focus on more is it's not about the drug or the alcohol or the behavior. It's about what's leading someone to use that to begin with. And, you know, people don't use drugs because they're addictive. People use drugs because they're helpful. They actually solve a problem. The problem of isolation, disconnection, loneliness, suppressing trauma, helping people feel safe and connected. And so that's really the focus, I think, if we're talking about transforming out of addiction, is not focusing on how many days are you away from your drug or your alcohol or your behavior. Are you actually working on the issue that's leading you to the addiction to begin with? Because if you actually heal the root or the roots of your addiction, the idea of relapse is just, it's not even like in the question anymore. Like, I want to help people transform so much that the thought of going back to their addiction is just not even an option because they're just a different person now. And I think the process of transformation is really about creating a life that you don't want to run away from, both internally and externally. And so if that means changing your environment, your friends, the activities that you're doing, even the things that are in your, you know, in your home, like changing the things that are on your walls, changing the music that you're listening to, the foods that you're eating. I invite people to do a life audit and look at all the things in their life. And is this creating joy and inspiration, or is this contributing to suffering? And that can help people slowly transition. I think community is so important. That's why we created Psychedelic Recovery. We've had over 8 groups a month for almost 7, 8 years now. And we just meet regularly. And it's a group for people that are using psychedelics to either break out of addictive patterns or supporting them on in long-term recovery. And everyone has a different approach to addiction recovery. We really meet people where they are and view it from a harm reduction lens. And that can be, you know, it can be a more difficult path than the total abstinence path because psychedelics, you know, invite people to really face themselves in recovery and face everything that they've been running away from. And I think that's important as we heal addiction is, you know, addiction is an attempt to run from our shadow, and psychedelics help us face our shadow. And sometimes people in recovery, if they are healing from addiction and they face their shadow, that can cause relapse because they don't have the support around them to actually face all the things that they were running away from. So encouraging people to have support networks, people that they can talk to, community around them, and being willing to go through that sacred fire of transformation, which means that you have to face everything that you have, you know, been avoiding through your addiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just, it's, you know, watching the development of this has been so refreshing because, you know, the biggest critique of AA and NA, especially given Bill Wilson's history, is that it's abstinence situation. And I had a friend of mine who probably heard me tell the story, Adrian. He's, you know, was addicted to heroin for about 15 to 20 years and was one of Dr. Mesh's first subjects at St. Kitts. And he, he doesn't have his habit anymore. And he moved on. But he's like, I couldn't go to AA or NA and talk about it. Like, here I wanted to find community in my recovery community, and because of the abstinence issue, there was no way for me to really share about this. So I think, like, watching this development is like so needed, but so many people are finding healing through these processes, and then they're not really accepted back into their own community of people who are also, and then not even be able to tell them, hey, everybody, there's this other model that might actually really work for you. It's almost like, no, you can't say anything here. So was that an influence for you, or is that sort of motivation for you to kind of work on this? Or, you know, because I hear so many people complain about that, and how do you get the word out to more of those folks in those communities so they can see there's another option?
Absolutely. Yeah, I used to be forced to go to 12-step programs, and it never fully worked for me. And I just want to say I really respect anyone that's in the 12-step program. I know it can be effective for a lot of people. It's a model that has worked for many, and it's important that we have other options. And so there's, you know, Psychedelics in Recovery, which is a 12-step group that welcomes people that use psychedelics in their 12-step program. And because I just never felt connected with the 12-step program. I created a different model, which is psychedelic recovery, which is a harm reduction model, non-12-step model, inviting people from, all different walks of life and different philosophies that are not identifying with the 12-step program to also find community and healing. So it was definitely inspired because I saw there, just there needs to be an other routes and other options for people. And, I don't think our way is superior. I don't think any way is superior. Whatever works for anyone, is important, and I view addiction recovery as sort of like this tree. There's many paths for different people. And we do get a lot of people that have actually been harmed by the 12-step model that come to our groups or haven't found it helpful. And then we also get people that love 12 steps and they also love our group as well. So it's nice to just, welcome people from all different backgrounds and philosophies.
Yeah, and it seems like with a lot of these sort of these dynamics, it's the more, some people are like, no, it needs to be this sort of only this route, but the more ideas there are, the more opportunities for people to explore. It creates a complexity and sophistication behind it. So now there's a deeper understanding of the mind, of addiction, of recovery, all that kind of thing that maybe wasn't just happening with the one standard. Now, for people that don't really understand the difference between like, well, what is a 12 step? What is not a 12 step? What things are you doing slightly different than the 12 step, for those that maybe aren't familiar with this area of study?
I think some of the core differences are that the 12-step model says that addiction is a disease and that you're going to be an addict or an alcoholic for the rest of your life. And so I don't, resonate with the disease model or that it's a genetic thing or that's, addiction is a disease. I believe it's actually an intelligence and a deeply ingrained coping mechanism that is not genetic. It's actually a response to ancestral trauma that's passed down through generations. And addiction is an attempt to try to resolve the trauma or an attempt to try to soothe an underlying issue, but it doesn't mean that someone has a disorder or an addiction, and that, or I'm sorry, or a disease. And that disease model really came out of the DSM as a way to classify people. And I think that, what we teach is addiction is temporary and it's not something that is, you're going to have for the rest of your life and you can actually evolve out of it. And it doesn't mean that you're going to be a drug addict for the rest of your life. So that's one aspect of it. I think another aspect is, the 12-step program teaches about powerlessness. And some people really do identify with feeling powerless over a drug or an alcohol or a behavior when they're in that active process of addiction. And, for me, and the reason why I introduced a different model is if I believed I was powerless over drugs, then I would be addicted now. It wasn't until I found that I was more powerful than the drugs that I reclaimed my own power, my own sovereignty that helped me overcome my addiction. And then just other aspects of it is the total abstinence model in the 12-step program. They don't allow for other drugs to be, or, other substances to be a part of the program. You have to basically abstain from all alcohol, drugs, behaviors, or whatever you're addicted to. And within our program, we practice targeted abstinence. So basically, that means that for me, I've had a previous addiction to opioids and pharmaceutical drugs. So I abstain from those drugs, but I allow for healing medicines like ayahuasca or microdosing to be a part of my recovery. And we're also fluid with it. We're not counting days. I don't think that our success is, I've been free of addiction for this many days. It's really, are you happy with your life? Are you feeling freedom? Are you thriving? Because I have a lot of friends that, and even clients that have been in the 12-step program. Like a client of mine was in the 12-step program and he came to me and he said, I've been free of alcohol addiction for 30 years. I can promise you I'm not going to drink tomorrow, but I can't promise you I'm not going to blow my head off. And it's like, is that how we're defining recovery? Is just in how many days you've been free of addiction? Or is it, are you happy? Are you thriving? And so, yeah, there's a lot of differences in the approach. And so I think it's important for people to find the pathway and the philosophy that resonates with them.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, it's such a powerful work that's being done, both in the regular 12 step, but then as you're saying, really being able to point out hey, here's the things that are challenging, here's the things that aren't working, here's how it's not making people happy, here's how it can be destructive. And you keep sort of referencing back your ayahuasca experience, and maybe just take a little bit of a step to the side here. And what was that? You often talk about these transformative experiences. We talk about these strange places people will go, or what is it like to have your first breakthrough? For me, that's like that was the most, yes, all the other experiences were amazing, but the first time I realized, like, oh, there's more to this world than just what's in my brain. What was that like for you? I mean, I'm imagining you've had quite a few of those at this point in time, but like, what's that first experience of breakthrough like for you when you, especially when you're working with stuff and you're really trying to deal with these inner experiences and some other challenges in life?
I'm so curious about your breakthrough experience too. I was, let's see, I was 9 months free of getting off of all these psychiatric drugs that I had been on. When I came off of these psychiatric drugs, I was completely debilitated. I could hardly talk, walk, function for months and months and months. I was suicidally depressed, wanted to die. I was taking thousands of milligrams of cannabis just a day just to function. I had all these withdrawal symptoms like brain zaps, and I couldn't see clearly. I couldn't think clearly, and just pain all over my body. And my first ayahuasca experience was just hours and hours and hours of purging and detoxing and just excruciating withdrawal in that ceremony. And I remember the medicine said, I'm going to show you a new way. And I had no idea what that way looked like. And I still feel like that, those words navigate my life. It's like every day that I live is a new way, but I have no idea. Like, I don't know the way knows the way. And I just trust that the way knows the way. And I mean, that's the life of an entrepreneur and a pioneer, really, is carving out a new way. You don't know what the way is. No one's ever done that way, but you trust the way. And that, I remember after that first ceremony, I didn't have to take any more cannabis oil. And I just believed for the first time in my life that I could live life beyond addiction. And this is coming from being told by countless doctors, therapists, treatment centers, you're a drug addict. You're going to be an addict for the rest of your life. I remember my family was told, just give up on her. She's hopeless. She's never going to make anything of herself. And I was told I have to be on 15, 20 medications for the rest of my life. And that's just not true, And so that ceremony just was like, there's a new way. And I'm so grateful for that first experience. And I just remember after that, just feeling so much faith and belief that I was going to get better. And that me getting better didn't mean more drugs. And I just felt so supported by the community and the ceremony and held. And I felt like I had a new family for the first time ever. And, it wasn't just that one experience that tr helped me transform. It was, I kept going back to the medicine and really working with it and integrating and being a part of community. But that was definitely a breakthrough experience for me.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, and to honor the balance there, I'll share a little. It feels like there's two different for me. There's like the mushroom and the ayahuasca. And the ayahuasca was where I had to like really reconsider, oh, what does this mean, plant teacher, plant guide, plant spirit? Like what I'm in a conversation with something. Like that was kind of like the mental breakthrough with that one. But even in terms of like my first breakthrough, I mean, you have the intense mushroom experiences, and then the one where you're like, I can't not deal with this anymore. It's like, what is this? How big is this place, right? So you have those experiences sometimes where you eat some and you're like, oh, maybe this is bunk, and maybe it's no good, maybe these mushrooms are old, whatever else. And so I ate probably like 7 grams at the point in time when I was like done with it, and nothing was happening. And these were in the days of CDs, and I listened to one CD and meditate and then turn the lights off and then go deep into my space, right? And nothing was happening, nothing was happening. I smoked a bowl, just kind of having my experience. And I saw a candle in the corner of the room. I was like, oh, that's really interesting, the way this candle is like kind of moving, right? It's like, I wonder if I can get into kind of the rhythm of the candle. So I'm feeling like I'm mentally getting into this rhythm of this candle, right? And then all of a sudden I'm like, I wonder if I can make that candle go out. And as soon as I say that, whoosh, the candle went out, right? Now, I thought a million times it could have been the wind, it could have been this, it could have been whatever, millions of things it possibly could have been. But what the shock of it going out right as my unbeknownst to me trip was getting full bore, right? All of a sudden this candle goes out, and now my mind that was holding me back, my restrictive mind, was surprised. And then the mushroom experience went bam, like full through, 7 gram big mushroom experience. And all of a sudden it was like layers of information, right? Like circle and square patterns and everything, just like a Rolodex, or like a, like a file, just like papers and paper, and I could only read it through my temples. So I'd like be moving my head, but I couldn't, I didn't know what it was. We hear oftentimes about these big downloads people get or whatever. It felt like I was just downloading mass amounts of like cosmic information, right? And this is in 1996, I think. And this is like my first time where I was like really came clear that things like integration were important, because I was like, who do I even talk to about this? I'm not talking to my neuroscience professors. I'm not talking to any of my friends about this really, because they're all about like, hey, let's go party and have fun, or if my face is melting, isn't that cool? But not like, wow, you just read the storybook of the cosmos, right, through your temples. And so I like was walking around. I live in Ann Arbor at the time. Was walking around Ann Arbor at like 3, 4 in the morning, just trying to find somebody to talk to, because it was so profound and so different and so unusual. So that was my first like mushroom breakthrough experience, where you're like, wow, I can't unlearn that. I can't not pretend like that didn't happen. Like, what is this? Why is consciousness so unusual? And it's not like I had an experience of like, oh, I had a vision of me sitting on the couch watching some TV. No, it was like this multi-dimensional realm that I was in. Like, how interesting is it that it comes out of something that grows out of the ground, right? So for me, that was like really, really profound. And so I'm sure you could probably, lots of us share many, many stories of these inner worlds that people go to. And I'm super fascinated about that. I did my dissertation work on transformational experiences as well. And so I'm always fascinated to hear. That's why integration, I think, has been really, and I'm curious your thoughts on this. For me, integration, when I sit in a circle with people doing integration work, just to hear people's stories, just to hear their perspective of consciousness. What does the river or the lake look like from their perspective, right? We're all sitting around this big lake called consciousness, and everyone's ex describing in different ways. What, in terms of your, you said, I don't know, you said 7,000 integration. I don't know if I heard that correctly. Integration circles, you've done quite a few integration circles over the many years. Like, what is that like to sit in a circle and hear some of the profound stories that people share with you?
Well, that was such a beautiful story. I'm just like integrating what you said as well, of just how vast consciousness is and how multidimensional it is, and especially to have that experience so, early on and recognize the need for integration back in 96 is really powerful and impactful. It makes sense why that led you to, truly being a pioneer in integration work. So thank you so much for really leading the way in that for so many people. And yeah, the integration spaces are so powerful and profound, especially I think one of the biggest things, just the overall themes that we see for people, is just what you said earlier of how people don't have anywhere else to go to talk about these experiences and to really have these spaces where they can come and share about their experiences and not feel judged or shameful, or to have someone to share such a, an incredibly deep, powerful experience that they've had, and to have someone say, wow, I relate to that, or I experienced something similar to that, or you sharing that is changing my perspective, And that's so powerful, I think, for so many people. And after every integration circle or a recovery group, it's always a different group. I don't think I've ever been to the same group where it's the same people. And I just think that's so powerful. It's just so medicinal to have so many different perspectives. It's always a unique group and always so powerful and impactful. And people are so deep and inspiring. And I just love hearing about all these different experiences and journeys people have. And it's also a place where a lot of people come with questions and just don't feel alone on their journeys and come, they want to know about dosing and frequency and, I've had this really transformative experience. What do I do with it? What does integration actually mean? And I think we're always in the pursuit of that process. I recently got introduced to a really interesting integration modality where I did this journey where we actually recorded my experience, and it turned off my default mode network or my ego. And I was just, the soul comes online. And I was just talking from my soul for hours and hours into a microphone that was connected to my phone and recorded the experience. And then the place that I was working with actually requires you to listen to your recording of your experience and type it out word for word in a transcript. And then you go through that transcript with an integration guide that specializes in interpreting these transcripts. And so you actually have, I have like hundreds of pages of a transcript of my journeys now. And I can go back and say, I said this in my journey. And it's like, are you going to actually do that? There's physical proof now. Because so often it's so interesting because after this journey, I would have my ego would come up with these stories like, oh, nothing happened, didn't really mean anything. And then I go back and I listen to it and I read my transcript. It's like I actually had some breakthroughs in that experience, which is so powerful, because the ego just wants to erase it and wants to say it wasn't important or nothing happened. And so I think that this framework for, recording your experience and actually writing it out and transcribing it without AI is really powerful because you get to sit and listen to the things you were thinking about it. And it's not always effective. A lot of medicines, you can't really talk in the experience, but that's been really impactful and powerful for me to have that framework for integration.
Yeah, it's so great. Yeah, I mean, that's always the difficulty is like, how do you translate that information from words, from writing? Like, how do I, even I've tried to painting before, that doesn't work, because the confusion and everything's not working, sort of mechanically for me. But this idea of recording and then later transcribing is great. And I imagine you can also hear the music in the background too, because sometimes music, I think, or painting, if I, paint afterwards, I can remember something. I look at paintings I have now, journey from, 15, 20 years ago, and it's like boom, right back into it, right? So, but yeah, I like this idea of like, forcing yourself to transcribe what you listened to, what you shared, what you talked about, and then just having the wherewithal to actually continue speaking in that process. But this afterglow point you talk about is so important. And I always call it like the ayahuasca homework assignments, right? It's like, oh, you have these really difficult tasks that you've kind of been given by, ayahuasca. Do this thing, do this thing, do this thing if you want to heal and move forward in personal growth and transformation. And then 2 weeks later, you're like, eh, that was kind of hard. Maybe that wasn't really important. I don't know. Maybe that was just me speaking. I don't know what is, and then you forget a little bit longer, a little bit longer, and then you let it wear off month, 2 months down the road. And I'll just tell this real brief story here. I did that. I don't know if I told you this before, but I had these like three big like ayahuasca homework assignments. And I was living in Maui at the time, and somebody that was coming there every month to, was doing ayahuasca ceremonies. And I had these assignments. I didn't tell anyone about it except for myself. Sure enough, afterglow wears off. I start to throw those assignments to the side, not really thinking much about it. And 3 months go by, 4 months go by, no one's calling me about the ayahuasca. 5 months, 6 months, 7 months go by. I'm like starting to get worried. Like, I know he's flying from other places. I hope he's okay, et cetera, et cetera. 8 months go by, 9 months go by. I finished like one of my homework assignments finally. I was like, oh, that's right. I had those homework assignments. I was like, well, he's not coming around anyway. I might as well finish them up, right? So, second homework assignment was like, second and third homework assignment were like reconnecting and building relationships with some challenging situations, right? Did my second to last homework assignment. Okay, I'm feeling good. Go to do my last homework assignment. Sure enough, do the last homework assignment. Dropped the person off. We went and did this really beautiful hike through Haleakala. Dropped the person off at the airport the next day, like 11 o'clock. Drove back home. Literally opened the door, right? Ring, ring. Phone's ringing. Hey, you want to do ayahuasca this weekend? So it's like just a reminder of like, hey, there is a relationship that's happening here. And there are non-human beings, if you will, that are paying attention to what you do and hold you accountable. So, yes, it's good to have, community accountability, but also realizing that spiritual accountability that's happening. And if you kind of let it, dis if you dismiss it, you kind of throw it away, either you're going to revisit that in your next ceremony hardcore, and you're like, why is this so difficult right now? Because you didn't do your homework assignments, right? So it's like it's this back and forth. If you really want to get the most out of the materials, the best way to go about doing it is to follow through and do the things that like you said, some of the things that were transformative or know were important for personal and spiritual growth that maybe were just too difficult, but at the same time, knowing internally, hey, if I really want to be connected to source, I have to follow through here.
So true, so true. And those experiences, what I've seen, patterns people have had is they keep having the same journeys over and over again if they're not actually integrating and listening. And I'm so curious for you, what kind of homework assignments did you have?
Two of them were just relational stuff, and another one was I mean, just, all three of them are relational stuff, making sure I'm reconnected with a friend, making sure I'm reconnected with family members, dealing with some challenges that had come up that caused some rifts in the dynamics of family and that type of thing. So it was good. It was definitely worthwhile. And it's been, I mean, pretty amazing too, just to see how in the world of integration work, which is really holding yourself accountable or having a space for community to come in to do your homework assignments as well, or if you can really follow through on that, how far integration has come. In 2011, when we started doing it, you go to conferences and people were kind of mocking it and dismissing it. It's just people's egos talking. Why are you even doing this? It's like there's a lot of like bad negative energy towards it because they're like, oh, okay, well, it's just who needs to sit around and watch people's egos share about their big experiences? But then we were doing it in person, we're like, man, people are really liking this. And also, people were coming from other transpersonal experiences, right? People that were afraid to talk about their transpersonal experiences in any other circle felt really comfortable coming to a psychedelic or entheogenic circle where it was already going to be wild concepts and ideas, and they're, alien abduction or alien visitation or alien UFO experience didn't seem so weird comparatively to some of the other stuff you were talking about. So that's also been really fun to see, like the range of transpersonal experiences all feeling comfortable, because at the end of the day, these are the different tools we're using to access this space of consciousness that's beyond us, that's beyond anything that we know of, that's in this land of wonder and awe and mystery. So I think integration has been really helpful, especially because we're in this worldview that's like, if it's not measurable, it doesn't exist. And here we're talking about these medicines where almost everything that is involved with this inner world is not measurable, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, because it shows the change and transformation people can have from it.
Yeah, that's so true. So true. And I think one of the biggest aspects of the integration that we talk about frequently is reciprocity, like how to be in a reciprocal relationship with these medicines. And for us, it's been the work, being of service in the community and giving back. And that's to me the Decrim Nature and our work with Decrim Nature and my work with SFPS and your work with Erie, it's all integration. It's like I've received so much of support from these medicines, and it feels like my sacred responsibility to give back to them. And it's being in relationship. I'm always giving and receiving to the medicine. And I think it's so important, as we teach about integration and really come to it from outside of this extraction, colonizing mindset of like, instead of approaching these medicines of what can I get from this or what can this cure within me or what can this do for me? It's like, how can I give and receive to this relationship? And even, this conversation today is giving back to the medicines for how much it's helped us. And so I just always invite anyone that's integrating to be in that just inquiry, about their relationship with it and how are they giving and receiving in that relationship.
Yeah, and I think that's where even like the medicine model comes short, because with the medicine you don't really have to build a relationship with it. It's just a thing you take, and and of course we all talk about these as plant medicines and medicines as well, but in terms of like the medical or clinical framework, whereas these do require even that idea of animism, that there's a soul in what we're taking and that we're having a conversation, just shifts things dramatically. And I know, from my neuroscience mindset when I was an undergrad, if I talk to that person now, they'd be like, what are you talking about, right? But now, having had many experiences and realized the importance, and seeing, myself, the importance of building that relationship as if it is a relationship, that is something, and it's an intelligent being that we're engaged with, it just shifts how we, view everything. So I think that's, these little nuanced worldview situations that come into play are really critical in the healing process. And speaking to that, I wanted to try to jump into a little bit. You're doing some amazing work with James Fadiman, who, for those that don't know, did some incredible work in like the, I think, 1966, where he was looking at creative problem solving. I was doing some really groundbreaking work there, where to like invite professors and researchers from all over the world to, if they've been working on a problem for 3 months and haven't found anywhere to crack the nut on that problem, then they would go to Fadiman's work and off, I think it was like maybe 50 micrograms. It was kind of a minor dose. It wasn't a microdose, but it was a relatively, at least last I read, relatively minorish dose of LSD or psilocybin, I believe, to see if they can come up with any creative insights into their problem. Unfortunately, that was shut down in 1970 by Nixon and the Controlled Substances Act, which there's an interesting story around that too. But now you're kind of working with Fadiman on the other side of this sort of era of time where it's been stigmatized and criminalized and all this, and now kind of looking at microdosing. So tell me a little bit about that project. And also, probably for a lot of folks out there's a lot of mixed messages out there. Oh, microdosing just placebo. It's not placebo, but I know there was just some research project you did this summer that was looking into, what are the effects of microdosing, et cetera. So tell me a little about James Fadiman and your microdosing work, and then also some of the research that you've been doing since then.
Awesome. Yeah. I love James Fadiman. He's one of my favorite people on earth. I just really, aside from his pioneering work within psychedelics, he's just such a gem of a human being. He's so sweet. He's so funny. He's so humble. He's really, he's been in the psychedelic field for over 60 years. He's 80, he just turned 86 this year. He was one of the original psychedelic researchers, as you were mentioning, back in the 60s. And he pioneered one of the first LSD studies for alcoholism and was working in a clinic for a while when LSD was legal. And just, he used to study with Ram Dass. He was like Ram Dass's intern at Stanford and has just, a wealth of stories and information and experience in the field. And he's the first person to publicly talk about microdosing. And he's been pioneering the path of, modern microdosing research and protocols. He's the first one to develop microdosing protocols. And he's just really been putting himself out there for decades and decades and decades. So I just have, such deep respect for him and the work that he does, and also the humility that he brings into this work. He's just, yeah, just he'll answer any question from anyone. He always invites people to write to him. He just came out with a new book called Microdosing for Health, Healing, and Enhanced Performance. And it's a compilation of hundreds of stories of people that have come to him with all different types of issues and backgrounds. And they've really discovered, new applications for microdosing, such as chronic Lyme disease and long COVID and chronic pain. And the index of their book is all these different conditions of people that have been helped by microdosing. And I was just meeting with him yesterday. He just so happens to live literally 10 minutes from my mom. And so I get to see him whenever I'm in the Bay Area. I always go visit with him. And I was seeing him like every single month. And it's just such a treasure to spend time with him. And I brought my dad to go visit him yesterday. And my dad is a doctor at Stanford. He's a cancer doctor who I'm actually just started my dad on a microdosing protocol as well. And my dad was like, "Well, what's the best model for microdosing?" And we were really talking about that. And I think potentially the supplement model, or even how we talked about with Decrim Nature, like treating it like fruits and vegetables, taking it out of just medicalization. Because what we've found with microdosing research is that there's not just one ailment for microdosing, that it's actually a wellness supplement that can help, like James Fadiman talks about it, microdosing helps well people feel even better. And so I'm now working with a population of people that aren't dealing with a lot of, chronic health issues. And I also deal with populations of people with addiction and getting off of dependency to drugs and all different types of health issues. And both Yeah, all different types of populations of people can benefit from microdosing. I think, James Fadiman and I have been working together for over 6 years. We created several courses about microdosing. Then we had thousands of students all around the world during COVID. Jim Fadiman helped me re is helping me with the relaunch of my new training program, the Microdosing Facilitator Training, where I train therapists and practitioners to be certified microdosing facilitators. He's on the faculty. I also organized one of the first microdosing research studies this past year alongside Dr. Connor Murray. He is one of the only researchers that's studying microdosing research in the United States, and we used EEG headsets. We had a group of like 75 people in Santa Cruz that took, we were basically comparing two different varieties of psilocybin-containing mushrooms on the human brain in a decriminalized area. And we scanned people's brains before, during, and after the microdosing experience. And what the biggest takeaway that we found from that study is that our current measurements of how psychedelic and microdosing research is done is totally flawed, because you can't get a lot out of, studying the brain waves to understand the microdosing experience. So many people had experiences on the microdose that couldn't actually be measured by the changes in the brain waves. Connor has been doing microdosing research at UCLA, and I do want to say the federal government has actually prohibited a lot of the microdosing research in the United States because they prohibit any participant from taking the microdose home. And as we know, microdosing is not done, in a clinical lab. You have to take it home and do it on your own in a protocol. And there was a research study that just came out of New Zealand, which was the first one in the world where they actually let the participant take the microdose home. And they had a 60% improvement in depression symptoms. What Connor found is that he actually found that through his research at UCLA with LSD microdosing, is that it's not a placebo, and it actually created brain entropic growth factor when the participants were studied when they took the microdose. So it's now, the whole placebo theory has been debunked. There's actual changes in brain waves and changes in the outcomes in terms of people's mood, pain levels, productivity, focus. There's a lot of criticism on the microdosing space because of the current measurements of it just can't apply to microdosing. It's so nuanced in terms of the experiences that people have on microdosing. So I think we're just a long ways away from really understanding microdosing research. And I'm really interested in finding new ways that we can measure microdosing outside of the traditional model of how psychedelic research is being done, so that we can study people that are taking it home. But there's just so many things that are prohibiting that. But back to what I was saying is, like, it's not, we were talking about yesterday with my father of all these clinical studies that are being done. They have to just find one ailment, like studying it for depression or studying it for anxiety. And microdosing is not just for sick people or, mental health challenges. It's for so many different people and just a wide variety of people. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting how we're going to kind of steward forward microdosing research because it's so nuanced, and it's not these big breakthrough experiences. It's more of a subtle, slow shifts in someone's experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's so beautiful. And just even like one thing I'm among the many other things about psychedelic research in general, it forces the scientific method to revamp their whole system, whether it's the double-blind placebo for larger scale experiences, or if it's for trying to figure out how to best measure microdosing, whether it's from a neurodegeneration, which you're not going to be able to see over time, or putting them in the right environment so you actually can get the effects. You know, like all those things you mentioned are things that like are excluded out or like are taken out. You know, these are the things that we don't want to talk. This is the anomaly we don't want to talk about, right? But what is the anomaly? Is it, you know, what if that little piece of the puzzle that we're throwing away is actually so important to the measurement process? And so science has a lot to learn from, I think, from psychedelics. So it's great to see the work you're doing with Connor, and then even like bringing this in that community setting, doing some sort of finding, like being creative with like how can we use the tools we have and the information we have and the N of ones that, you know, Fadiman gets all the time. You know, how many N of ones, you know, you have at some point in time when anecdotes get to be like this big, you got to say, okay, something's going on here. Right? You can't just like throw them away, throw them away, throw them away. So I think that's really, really impressive, and I give you know, great credit for trying to figure out how best to measure that and to keep working with that, and not just kind of throw it out. As you see, there are these papers, even a paper recently that came out that sort of was kind of on the whole placebo track again. But you know, even still, that's fascinating in of itself. You know, why is this happening? So I want to thank you for that work. Now I know we have about 10 more minutes, but I do want to ask you one more question before we jump into the question of the Rachel is, you know, Decrim Nature Oakland. It all kind of, you know, out of nowhere, right? We just started talking, we started having this conversation. What are we going to do here? Tell us a little bit about that experience for the people out there that weren't able to be like, immersed into that sort of the nexus of goodness that was, bringing so many communities together, trying something totally new, being courageous, having to like, get up there and do your testimonies, not just a yes or no ballot initiative. What was that experience like for you, and what are some memories you have from the origins of Decrim Nature Oakland?
I just felt like this spiritual energy come through my body of just the remembrance of that time. It was just magic. It was just pure magic. I remember just there was so much energy around us and excitement and enthusiasm. I mean, this was back when there wasn't a lot going on with psychedelics at all. You and I, you were doing events for a while. I started doing some events when I, stepped up into the psychedelic society, but I remember I would go into cannabis dispensaries around Oakland because I was trying to get them all excited and involved in our movement when we were organizing these big events. And every dispensary that I went to was just like, you guys are crazy. This is never going to happen. I remember going into Oaksterdam University. They told me to leave. They said they didn't believe in it. And I didn't have support from any of these people at all. It was so interesting. If just like some of the pushback I remember getting. And now the same dispensaries are, selling psilocybin products, which is hilarious. But yeah, there was just a lot of disbelief that we were going to pass anything. And there was just so much excitement from the community. Like when we did that first, we brought together all the organizations locally, all the community members that we could. We had hundreds of people come together for this educational event, and everyone was just excited. No one really totally understood what we were doing. And then at the City Hall, we just had hundreds of people just line out the door of people sharing their stories. And there was just so much energy and excitement in that room. And I don't think any of us really understood the impact that it was going to make, back then. And it's just created such a huge fractal of impact on the world. It's just been phenomenal and so exciting. And what I loved about that time, it was just pure heart and that everyone was getting together around that one thing. There wasn't any infighting at all. There wasn't anyone, that was there that was like disagreeing with what we were doing. I just felt just unity in the community back then, just everyone coming together and really believing in it. And that's the one challenge that I do see in the psychedelic space, especially around politics now, is there's just infighting. There's certain influential groups that are kind of dominating certain movements. And what I love about the Decrim movement is just it's the people leading the movement, power to the people, and restoring our relationship with these medicines. And it's just so powerful. And I'm so excited and so thankful to you for all the work that you've continued to do in the space and, like inoculating all these different cities all around the United States and even globally. So thank you for carrying the movement forward. And I just absolutely loved working with you and Decrim Nature Oakland. It was such a special time, and I'm so grateful that we got to see the movement back then of where it was.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thank you for all that. I'm getting little chills remembering all the good stuff there. But especially like that you're saying, like there's like this. I think that's what helped was there was such disbelief, and also such belief.
Yeah.
It was almost like, of course this is gonna pass. And also like everyone like there's no way. Like the core team and the people that were coming in there is like we're on this like wave right now, and it's not stopping. And there's something about that, and just being the first one to do it, and the way that we did it, and like, through story, through emotional, like, transformative end of ones, people sharing, I still think about some of the stories that people shared. It's just like, wow, like people came together, 120 people we had that ended up giving testimony. That's like 240 minutes of time that the city council has to sit there and listen to some of these beautiful stories. But I think you're right on the point. There's something about that, like, nobody had caught up to us yet. Like now, there's, like you said, there's infighting, there's people like trying to stop and, stop progression. There's deep pockets who have influence saying, oh, this is not a viable option, despite the fact that it's the most successful policy that still exists in the US today. But at that point in time, it was like we were ahead of the game. We were like, people didn't even know what we were doing yet, and it already happened.
Yes.
And it happened so quickly, 6 months really, from January to June when it passed. And I think before people even had a chance to turn around and say, what's happening? it was already, moving forward. So I want to thank you as well for all your support in that, because I think it took all the community to come together to make that magical moment happen. But yeah, it was really something special. So thank you for participating.
It's such an honor. One of the highlights of my life, honestly. I'm so grateful that we had that opportunity and to be the first city in the world, really, to deprioritize entheogenic plants and fungi.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thank you, Danielle. This has been what's quite a wonderful conversation. We're going to toss it to Rachel for a couple questions, and then we'll close you out here. But thank you so much for such a great dialogue. Maybe we'll have you on digging a little deeper with some of these other questions later.
Oh, totally. That was a really wonderful conversation. You're very eloquent, Danielle, about talking about addiction and that whole idea of like going back to what's causing the addiction. I really, really resonated with that. I think people really vibe with that as well. My question was more along the lines of I was just telling Larry before you jumped on the call about how I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm talking to an omega level telepathic mutant because your name is similar to like this comic book character named Cassandra Nova. But my question is not that. My question is more along the lines of special abilities like telepathy or like really high empathy in people or I think those were like big dreamers or just like all of these things that we cannot explain in our like medical model. All of like the I can feel when my sister is in trouble, or like I know when my friend needs me, or like these things that we have as human beings that we can call magic powers or psychic abilities. I believe that oftentimes we do medicate with these different substances as a way to not hear all of it, right? Like if you were a Supergirl, you'd hear everyone screaming for help constantly, right? And so that would be enough to make you be like, I don't want to deal with this. So, what are your thoughts about how, human beings like we've like put it into like, oh, you're an addict if you are addicted to these substances, but it's I think a bigger thing than that, right? Because oftentimes people are turning towards alcohol to shut off your brain, or you just don't want to be here anymore. So, I really love how you talked about how it's like a bigger thing to that. But do you have any stories as to how? I mean, like I think that it has something to do with like if people are like a high telepathy or high EQ, they're going to probably be likely to fall into addictions because we don't have any support systems in our current society to deal with psychic. We don't have like an X-Men school for higher learning yet. So, thoughts on that, Danielle?
Oh, I love that question, Rachel. That's so beautiful. Thank you for that. I believe that pretty much across the board, anyone that experiences addiction is a highly sensitive person and oftentimes extremely gifted. I know for
That's the
myself,
word, yeah. Gifted, for sure. Yes.
And for me, I had a spiritual awakening when I was 15 and 16 years old. I was questioning the nature of reality. I was like reading Plato in high school and believing in unity consciousness and
Yeah.
connection with God. And I realized, I was actually an indigo child. There's this whole philosophy of indigo
I just
children.
got full body tingles when you just said that. Like, I knew it. Yeah.
How did
Sorry,
you
go
know
ahead.
it?
There's just a frequent like your earrings also. I just like I can see all the geometry on like reverberate like vibing off you and your background like it's I was like wow. I was telling him like I'm nervous. I'm talking to like an omega level like mutant right now. It's like I can read my whole like mind and stuff, but like it's those who are called to walk certain paths. It's challenging. It just is. Like heroes' journeys of that level are obviously you're going to have certain things that are going to be challenges that no others are going to be able to deal with except for maybe a small group. And I think that through entheogens, even Larry talking about the candle thing, I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. Like, so I think these abilities in all of us, those of some of us. Are meant to light the torch first or be the wayfinder or like figure out how we would practice something like that. So, sorry, go on, Danielle.
So true, so true. Well, thank you for who you are and your soul and the gifts that you have, and to see the gifts in other people. I think that's really beautiful and powerful. And I realized that I think there's like this whole philosophy that there's indigo children, rainbow children, crystal children. It's Dolores Cannon introduced this philosophy that there's this wave of highly intuitive, advanced, spiritually advanced, sensitive souls that are here to, basically shift the paradigm on Earth. Oftentimes we get put on medications, we have addictions because we're highly sensitive and we have intuitive and spiritual capabilities that in our current matrix of reality are not supported or encouraged. And I know in my family, my parents are atheists and my dad's a doctor, and my spiritual awakening and my resurgence of my gifts as a child was looked at as too much, too sensitive, too crazy. And I was put on all these medications to just keep everything down. And I do think that was a part of my spiritual journey. I'm curious what I would have been like if I had my spiritual gifts to be encouraged as a child and not suppressed. But yeah, I think across the board, people that are extremely highly sensitive and highly gifted and highly intuitive, we're not taught how to harness that energy or to channel that energy. So our natural response in this reality is just to suppress, keep everything down. And so as we heal, and as the way showers, the wisdom keepers, the seekers, the spiritual ones heal, it's about harnessing that energy and really recovering, understanding, emerging those gifts, and to recognize that, I don't believe that there's anything as being too much, too sensitive, feeling too much. That's actually a sixth sense that we have. The third eye is to be able to feel deeply. And I think that's the ultimate gift. And so as people recover or uncover out of the slumber of suppression, how can we really encourage people to harness into their gifts and to, keep deepening into them, keep getting curious about them, keep inquiring why we're having these awarenesses, and to, I think the recognition that there's a veil, and for some people there is no veil actually. The veil is so thin that it's not even there anymore, and people are learning how to weave the mystical with the mundane. And that's the whole point of, working with psychedelics, is to be have your feet in both worlds ultimately.
Oh.
You remind me too when you're saying that. Then this kind of ties into the mutant character too, because the name is Cassandra, right? The Cassandra complex. The Cassandra complex is when you're too intuitive, or you're too able to sort of forecast or intuit the future, and you tell somebody about it,
And no one
because
believes
they're not
you.
there, no one believes you. So that's like the sort of the problem, the paradox, right? And so again, talking about community and society holding that in a good way, at some point in time, you like do this enough times and you get shot down that you're like, why am I even doing this, right? So yeah, of course, I'm gonna do something else that can maybe like hinder that, so I don't feel the necessity to like share it and then get sort of mocked or sort of made fun of or what have you. So yeah, I imagine that's definitely the case with highly intuitive people, which there are seemingly a lot of them out there. But we also have found so many ways to suppress things nowadays that it's fun to see them popping out. And I think I often say this is like this will be one of those things. This movement will be one of those things that 10, 20, 30 years down the road, people will be like, "That's what everyone was talking about." Enough people have turned on to these different materials, these different substances, plant teachers, to realize that there's more. Maybe now they're just like, "Oh, this is a human rights issue," or "Oh, I've had a few of these experiences," or "Oh," but like realizing, like, "Wow," then they'll be looking back to this time and be like, "And those guys were really, really ahead of the game because, we couldn't have that conversation really even in this kind of deep way, in terms of like intuitive feelings and sort of." Even the word of psychic experiences is still taboo. You can't really talk about that, right? But yet it's happening all over again. You mentioned twins and sisters, and knowing when your relative is feeling bad, your friend is going to call you, and you pick up the phone at the
We
same
do
time.
psychic things all the time, right? But there's no place for us to like practice that with each other, right? And maybe we can like together with all our powers combined, perhaps we can really do like a really big shift and maybe something, a really big miracle, So.
I want to practice with you.
Yeah, I'm down.
Podcast part two, we're only talking about this topic, so
Coordinated effort, right? And
yeah.
I feel like it's time now for that, right? Because if we all believe in the magic, then what's reality then, right? I
It's
prefer a
true.
more magical one.
And
Saying.
I think one of this sounds totally out there, but I'm just gonna say it. One of my biggest challenges in this life has felt like I don't feel at home on Earth. And doing matrixy, earthy things has always been difficult for me. My parents were always like, "You're such a difficult child." And it's like, well, maybe this because being on Earth was really hard for me. And the awareness and understanding indigo children, understanding cosmic consciousness that potentially our souls are from a different planet or galaxy, and that we're encompassing a human body, but we're consciously from a different star system, potentially. This sounds totally out there,
No,
but
I
like,
got you. I read a lot of comic books,
I
and
love it.
encoded in that, like people are like, "Oh, you think it's just a comic book?" You think I'm like, okay, but in there is like a deep truth. Whatever that means to come from another star system, we only have like what NASA tells us. So think bigger about what that really means when we can learn from each other from a bigger galactic level.
And even outside of star systems, like even just like what happens after death, there are
Oh
realms. They say that those realms exist and we're somewhere else. And you hear about these places like soul homes or places that people go to, and they're like, "Oh yeah, actually, I've always been here." Like, why when people come to these experiences, they say this is more real than real?
Because
That's
the great
fascinating.
remembering, right? It's like
Yeah.
remembering something that's
Oh,
the
this is really
real thing,
cool. Yeah,
right?
this
And then
is.
you're like,
Familiar for me, like, why? I've never been here before. This is a totally other dimension, and it feels like I'm home. Like, what's
yes.
that all about, right? So I hear you on all that.
Oh
That's
my gosh, I'm getting like
I
the
don't think I have
tingles.
to even really have to tiptoe around that because that's such a constant
Yes,
in
yeah.
different experiences that people are saying. So at least in terms of the question of like, why is it occurring? What is the experience that creates the sensation of being more real than real when all we've known is real? And now we have the sense of, oh, this is more real than that. Like, what does that even mean? Like, these are the kind of questions I'm excited for science and philosophy of psychedelics to get into, but we're still 20, 30 years, I think, outside of underground, kind of exploration in terms of the mainstream conversation, which is still mental health, that kind of thing. But these are the types of questions I think that when we start getting into there and tapping into that, which is what integration allows us to do a little bit, that's when the fascinating work really begins, I think. So, really awesome. Great
Oh my
conversation
gosh, that
today.
was my question. I'm gonna go back to you, Larry. We will
Yeah.
definitely practice. And yeah, in 2026, it's already prophesized in comic books that the resurgence of like real superheroes come back into this world. So
Great.
whatever that means, I'm ready for it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Rachel, for that. And thank you, Danielle. It's such a great conversation. I know we could probably talk about all the things and all the different ways, and I think that's what's so enjoyable about having you on a podcast is because you can kind of go to all the different tendrils of conversation, and that's super fun. So I really appreciate you being here, and I look forward to the next time we'll get you on, maybe in a year or so when you have, or at this point in time maybe 6 months out, we have when you have some more information about some of the work you're doing. And speak to us a little bit about Lumeria. I think you said, is that the one program? And then any other programs, how are people going to contact you? What are best ways for people to reach out and get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you both so much. I am just so lit up by this conversation and so grateful for both of you and your powerful consciousnesses and just the incredible work that you do and just who you are as individuals. I feel just really grateful to be colleagues in this path. And thank you to anyone that has been listening. Thank you for, your soul as well. I think it takes a certain individual to embark in this path with psychedelics. So just honoring the listeners and the paths that you're on and the individual work that you're doing and working with these powerful allies of ours with these substances and spiritual partnerships that we're in with entheogens. And you can find me on my website, lumerianow.com, Lumeria now.com. I have a program called Breakthroughs where I guide people through month-long microdosing protocols. And in 2026, I'm relaunching my microdosing facilitator training program. And that's going to be starting in March. And then you can also find me on Instagram, connect with D and Psychedelic Society SF, also psychedelicsocietysf.org and psychedelicrecovery.org are my websites. And yeah, just encouraging anyone to reach out to me. My email is connect@lumerianow.com. I'm always available for questions and collaborations and just love meeting new people on this path.
Well, thank you, Danielle. And for everyone out there, please reach out. You have quite a wisdom figure on your hands here. So reach out and have some conversations and check out the new projects. I know you're always doing fun new things. So it's exciting to keep up with what you're doing. Appreciate you being here. Thank you, Danielle. Reminder to everybody, we go live usually every 2 weeks. Right now, our next show looks like it's going to be on the 14th. So in 2 weeks from now, on December 14th, we're going to have Laura Shapiro and Kat as well. Kat from Plant Medicine People, and Laura Shapiro, who's doing some work with Iboga, has an all-woman organization that works with Iboga. Really, really fantastic folks there. I'm excited to have them on as well. And that's going to be on about 2 p.m. Pacific on December 14th. And we'll take a little break for the holidays. And then our next podcast after that will be on January 11th. So keep us in mind. Subscribe to our channel if you haven't to keep updated in what we're doing. Keep in mind that we're booked out probably till about April now with an incredible lineup of guests. And we're going to keep going. This is, it's so many good leaders out there, so many people doing amazing work, so many sort of grassroots folks that just have great ideas in their heads that we just love to talk to. So I'm glad for you to be here, Danielle, and for everyone else as well. And thank you for all the listeners. Reminder that this program, this podcast will be live on our podcast channels probably next Sunday or a little bit after that, probably next Sunday on Spotify and other places. So check that out if you get a chance. And thank you again, everyone, for listening. Thank you, and Danielle and Rachel for the conversation. And until next time, tune in, stay rooted, and let's grow together. Have a great night, everybody. Happy Sunday.
Thank you.